Thanks to Hired for sponsoring today's episode of Does Not Compute. It can be pretty terrible to look for a new job. It's time-consuming and just generally not a very fun experience. Hired has completely streamlined the job search process, though. After you spend a few minutes filling out your profile, employers will send you personalized interview requests. What's really awesome is that those interview requests include salary and equity information up front. That means you don't have to waste time going through the whole interview process just to find out at the end that the salary offer doesn't match what you're looking for. Over 4,000 companies all around the world are on Hired, from tiny startups to massive companies like Facebook. They're looking to hire full-time and contract employees in 17 of the biggest tech cities across North America, Europe, Asia, and Australia. Hired also hopes to protect your privacy by hiding your profile from your current and past employers. It's completely free to sign up and use Hired, and they'll actually give you a $1,000 bonus to say thanks when you find your next job using them. If you sign up at hired.com/doesnotcompute, they'll double that thank you bonus to $2,000. So, how's the new place, Sean?
Oh, right now I'm sweating. It's hot. It's humid, Paul. The place is good, though. I mean, it's bigger than what I had. It's half, the rent is literally half, or actually less than half of what I was paying before. And I think I have a couple hundred square feet more. So, I can't complain.
That's ridiculous. Wow.
Yeah, and I know, right? It's pretty, there's a whole bedroom I don't know what to do with. So, right now there's a yoga mat in it, and that's it.
That sounds very peaceful.
Yeah. I mean, granted, the moving truck hasn't come yet. So the past few days for work, I had stacked two boxes on top of each other that came from Amazon, and I was using those as a desk. And I went to the hardware store and got just a piece of crap foldable lawn chair.
Nice.
So my back is all jacked up. I have a mattress coming on Wednesday, but in the meantime, we've been using these camping mattresses that you kind of blow up. They're really thin, and that is also destroying my back. So between the lawn chair and the camping mattress, I need to see a chiropractor.
Like a Therm-a-Rest.
Yeah, exactly. Therm-a-Rest.
Those things are great, but probably not so great for weeks at a time.
No, it'll be 2 weeks, maybe 2.5, almost 3 weeks by the time the stuff gets here.
Oh God.
Yeah. So, but it's good. I mean, sounds small, but it has everything that I need. Everything's walkable. The grocery store actually has good produce. A lot of local produce, a lot of quality stuff, which is nice. So it's been good. I went to the hardware store and I got a cast iron skillet, and I've been cooking everything in that.
Nice. Is there any sort of like tech scene in the area, or nothing really at all? Because I mean, I know it's a college town, so I guess there must be some kind of tech interest, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's a college town in the sense that the college has, you know, 600-700 students. And the town has 600-700 people. So it's a college town in the sense that literally the college is half the town.
So I guess probably not so much on the tech side of things then.
Right. So when I went and visited with Jamie last winter, maybe January, I think it was, I talked to a few of the staff members at the school. It's Virginia Law School, or not Virginia, Virginia. It's Vermont Law School. And a couple of the staff said that their significant others or spouses were actually programmers that telecommuted. And they were working from home in the area. So there are programmers around. When I first started looking into Elixir, I noticed that there was a few prominent Elixir devs in the Vermont area. So I think it's up in Burlington, maybe, which is like an hour away. So there's a little bit around, you know, there's some interest, but certainly not as big as the Bay Area.
Do you think that's going to be kind of a weird change for you, or not so much? Because, I mean, you tend to be more introverted, as we've discussed before on the show.
Hermit-like, you mean?
Hermit-like, yeah, that's a way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I don't have, you know, face-to-face interaction with developers every day anymore because I'm not going to into an office. But in terms of like my broader community of developers that I know, I don't think it changes anything because most of them I have never met in real life, or maybe just once, you know, somewhere. But yeah, so most of my interactions, you know, are coming across from Twitter or Slack or something. So it doesn't change it that much, I don't think.
That's pretty cool. And I mean, it sounds like there's at least a handful of other people in the area that are also telecommuting. So that seems like there's a bit of a local community, at least.
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of the, because of the school, you know, there's a lot of younger people around, which is kind of nice. So it's not like because I've definitely lived in antiquated towns where it doesn't feel like there's nothing. It feels like there's nothing happening. You know, everyone is way older than I am and stuff like that. So, I mean, there's a certain element of that here, but there's a lot of younger people too because of all of the law school students coming into town. I feel like in the past few days, I've seen more moving trucks than I have almost road vehicles, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense given the time of year. School's starting up.
Yeah, but it'll be all right. I've already kind of got a routine going, just working from home for a little bit and then going to a coffee shop that's a quarter of a mile away and just walk there. It takes 5 minutes. Hanging out there for a while and coming back home and cooking dinner and maybe working for a little bit more.
Well, so how's their Wi-Fi?
It's all right. I mean, it seems like the average is like between 20 and 40. So
that sounds better than the roaster in Santa Cruz.
The roaster was like two, maybe, before everyone showed up even. So it hasn't been that bad, really. It's more of just a waiting for my stuff to get here, waiting for my guitars more than anything, because I don't have any guitars with me right now or any sort of musical equipment. So just kind of sitting around.
So since your music stuff isn't there yet, how have you kind of been like getting away from the computer? What kind of stuff have you been doing? Just exploring the town?
I haven't really. If I'm not working, I'm Netflixing or something like that right now, just because I've been so tired from, and so on the end of the trip, we got tired of driving. So we just skipped a night of camping and kept driving. So it ended up being like an 800 mile day and then one rest day and then a 900 mile day the next day. So just been kind of recovering from that a little bit.
That's brutal.
Yeah, but it hasn't been too bad. So it's kind of nice to be, it feels like I'm on vacation almost. For now. And then I know that when school starts up, Jamie will be really busy and it'll just kind of get back into routine. But I'm looking forward to having less distractions around, I guess, like from the external world. So I can dive into Elixir more, dive into JavaScript more, and not just kind of like hack around a little bit, but actually deepen my learning a bit. We can probably chat about this a little bit too, but I've been wanting to, as much as it pains me to say this, move towards ES6. Instead of writing CoffeeScript for all of my JavaScript. And I have a few reasons for that, but I ended up buying Wes Boss's ES6 course that he released recently. So I'm probably going to dive into that.
Nice. So what's prompted that?
Lots of thinking. I mean, I still really enjoy CoffeeScript, and I have nothing against it at all. I think the biggest pull towards ES6 is just the sheer number of people that are writing it. So, I mean, a lot of people argue against CoffeeScript for transpilation, but you can't really, you kind of have to have it, you know, unless you're writing pure JavaScript, you know, ES5. Even with ES6, you're transpiling all the time and all that stuff. So that hasn't really been a factor. You know, people are saying, I don't want to use ES6 because of transpiling. So that hasn't really affected me at all because I'm already doing that. So I think the biggest thing is that there's just so many people using it, so many libraries, so many tools are built using it. Maybe I'm getting tired of swimming against the grain or swimming up the river, so to speak, and want to turn around and float for a little while, maybe see how it feels.
Yeah, I mean, I think ES6 is definitely something that anybody who's doing JavaScript full time or a lot of the time should absolutely be trying. Personally, I've written several projects out in it, and I'm not a fan, but I know a lot of people are, and there are a lot of great tools out there for people who like that ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly, and it's kind of funny because, as much as I complain about JavaScript, I think I tweeted this yesterday, as much as I complain about JavaScript and the ecosystem around it, you can do some pretty amazing things with it. And that's basically the reason why I continue to jump a little farther into Node and use it a little bit and continue to jump, you know, switching from Coffee to ES6, try to go a little more mainstream, see what that's like. Because, you know, since my career started, I went from jQuery to CoffeeScript. I mean, when I say jQuery, I mean like stringing jQuery plugins together and not really writing anything in depth. And then all of my actual kind of difficult JavaScript experience is surfaced around CoffeeScript. And so I guess when I look back at my depth of experience, I kind of want to round it out a bit, I guess. I think that's honestly the biggest pull for me is looking around at job boards and stuff like that, looking around about like different requirements, and pretty much all of them will say JavaScript and not necessarily CoffeeScript. So maybe that's kind of a weird a reason to switch for something that I enjoy, but I feel like I need to experience that side of JavaScript a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, one of the reasons that I personally am such a big fan of CoffeeScript is because my background was in raw JavaScript, no library at all. My first full-time programming job was primarily maintaining this JavaScript library that was just JS and like manually implementing animations because we had to keep it under a certain number of kilobytes. We couldn't include any libraries to do any of this stuff. So like learning all of that in plain old JS that had to work from IE 5.5 on. So I have had my fill of that world.
Yeah, so maybe I'll get into it and hate it and switch back. But I figured, you know, it's worth checking it out a little bit at least. And I keep saying like pulling back and seeing the bigger picture is important. And it's just such a big thing for me because I'll get into JavaScript and be like, this kind of sucks. And then I'll pull back and think about all the stuff you can do with it. You know, it has such a wide range of usage. It's pretty unbelievable, honestly. So you start to think about that and you're like, but maybe I can put up with some of the stuff that I don't necessarily enjoy right now. Another interesting thing I saw maybe yesterday, I think it was on Twitter, was Ryan Florence and TJ Holloway Chuck. If you're not familiar with either of them, TJ is super prolific in the Node community. For example, he created Express. I'm pretty sure he was the original creator of Express and a number of other pretty influential projects. And Ryan Florence is the guy that started React Router, which is basically the router for React. So, you know, he has a lot of experience in the JavaScript world. And they were talking back and forth about, TJ was basically talking about how he's been messing around with Elm a little bit. And they were talking about transpilation and all that stuff. But one thing that Ryan said stuck out to me. He was like, puberty is kind of awkward, huh? And he was talking about how basically where JavaScript is right now is, you know, coming from ES5 to ES6 and ES7, even after that, and all the new features coming in and all the stuff. And it is really awkward right now. There's a lot of strange things. There's a lot of complicated things about JavaScript right now. But it just kind of put that into perspective for me, I guess, when he said puberty is awkward, huh?
It really does feel like that. It's like all of a sudden, JavaScript was pretty much the same for a very long time. And then we got like ES5 stuff, which existed for many years, especially in the Node environments. That was just a thing. And you wrote ES5 for a very long time. And now all of a sudden, within the last, you know, couple of years, ES6, ES Next, all this stuff has come out and they're just adding so many things so rapidly that I think a lot of people just don't really get time to learn what all's there and how to actually properly use it. And so a lot of the times you'll look at these ES6 code bases, and I don't think this is necessarily the fault of the people writing it. I think it's just kind of the nature of such rapid advancement. But you'll look at this code a lot of times and it's just kind of very difficult to follow.
No, I totally agree. People are using features that they necessarily shouldn't necessarily be using for certain things, you know, just because they're like, oh, this is ES6 and it's awesome. I'm going to use it in all these places. So yeah, it's kind of, I guess, growing pains. And it feels like the JavaScript world has been going through growing pains for so long now. I can't even remember. Maybe it seems like longer than it has actually been the last few years, I suppose. But yeah, just, you know, thinking back to when jQuery plugins were huge, and that was how life was done. You made a plugin for stuff and you used it. And that seems like a lifetime ago, but really it was only just a few years ago, right?
Yeah. I mean, even jQuery is, what, 10 years old or so at this point? That's really not that long in the grand scheme of things, but it feels like ages. And JS has gone through so many different kind of shifts throughout those 10 years. I mean, before that, JavaScript really wasn't even taken seriously. And then jQuery came out and all of a sudden people were like, oh, I get this. This makes sense to me. I can make cool stuff with it easily. And then, you know, we got all the other frameworks around that time and people just kind of generally accepted, oh, you can do some cool stuff with JavaScript. You get things like processing JS and people start doing more visualizers in the browser. And Node comes along. Suddenly JavaScript can run pretty much wherever. And you have proper, you know, module exports and that sort of stuff for building out a structured code base. And it now we're at this ES6 stage and ES Next where all of these things are just kind of being added. And the language, I mean, if you look at ES6 code, it really doesn't even really look like JavaScript. If you showed that code to someone from 2011, they might think it was an entirely different language.
Yeah, certainly some of the syntax, you know, the arrow functions and the new way of importing, how you can import multiple functions from a module in one line. Oh, man, it's so crazy to think back. Modules were such a huge thing for me, like a fundamental shift in how I thought about programs. Because when I first started writing JavaScript, it wasn't really a thing that you did, or at least I wasn't aware of it, you know. And I remember hearing about require.js, and I would think to myself, "Why? That sounds really complicated. Why would you want to do that?" And then I think I started using classes, and then, you know, having classes with class methods started making more sense. And then that's when modules really clicked for me. I was like, oh, that makes so much sense. You know, modules are super useful and I understand now. Just, I don't know. I don't know why. It just really, when you mentioning that triggered that memory of modules being such a transformative thing for me.
Yeah, I think that was the case for a lot of JavaScript programmers. It's like you would have, you know, a few different files that each did their own thing. and then you would add all those files into your page, and then the page would run and the files would execute and it would be fine. And so having the ability to actually structure things properly instead of just having a few files strewn about your application was kind of a big deal for a lot of people. Many apps had no concept of an architecture for JavaScript. It was just like throw some files in a thing and then add them to the HTML and then we're good, right? And so that was such a radical shift. It's kind of funny to think about in retrospect.
Yeah, it's interesting too to look at, well, for me, for example, you know, coming through JavaScript and then going to Ruby and then writing Ruby like I was writing JavaScript and not really grasping modules or even just how classes worked there. I guess I understand how they worked, but syntactically it was different. So it didn't click for me for some reason. And then going from the Ruby world to Node and being like, whoa, this is strange, because with Rails, I was like, I know what to do with everything. But in Node, people are like, do whatever you want, you know, make it a lib directory. Don't make a lib directory, make an app directory. It's just so, so different. And for me, when something's disorganized or I don't know how to organize something, it makes most problems so much more complicated to solve, right? So when I first started learning how to build a web app with Node, I didn't even know where to start because I didn't know where to put my stuff. With Rails, at least, I knew exactly where things went. You know, they had their guide where they're like, in the controller folder, this is obviously where all your controllers go, for example, right? Well, with Node, you don't necessarily have controllers, right? You didn't necessarily have models. You didn't necessarily have any of that stuff. And you just kind of made files as you needed them and put them where you wanted. Now there's different frameworks that encourage, you know, different file structures. But that was the hardest. That was honestly the hardest thing to me about learning Node, was not necessarily learning Node's API, right? Because it's not that big. It wasn't necessarily learning a framework's API because they're not that big. It was more of a, how do I put this thing together? What do I do with these puzzle pieces?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that's one of the big things that I, to this day, love about Rails is, especially for people who are new, it gives just such an instant sense of where everything has to be. Everything has a place, right? By default. You don't have to make any of those decisions. They've already been made for you. Even for stuff like your CSS, your JavaScript, everything that has to do with your app already has a defined spot to live. And of course, there are downsides to that. And for advanced programmers, sometimes you're going to want to break those rules, definitely. But one of the hardest things about learning, like you were saying, is just knowing how to structure things. Because application architecture is kind of a big deal and also extremely complex if you don't have any idea what you're doing.
Yes, exactly. The architecture thing, the blueprint that kind of puts everything together. Because as a programmer, it's not that hard for me to go through documentation and pick and pull what I need and put it together. But if I don't have an architecture to kind of fall back onto or a set of instructions without the experience already being there, it's kind of difficult to make those decisions on your own. Or you make those decisions and find a blog post saying you're wrong or something, right? Or you find more documentation and that says you did it wrong, right? And so I think that was the biggest thing for me was committing to a decision, I suppose, not wanting to be wrong or not wanting to have to redo something or not wanting to have to leave something being subpar, I guess. It's also really encouraging to me, just the progress happening, the conversations happening, the tools being made. It's all really, I don't know, it's still exciting to me. And I still just, as much crap as I see happening, you know, around people firing shots on Twitter at other people or people writing articles about stacks of technology or whatever, I'm still excited about all of it underneath. So I guess I'll just let today be my Twitter resource day, where I pull all of my stuff from Twitter. But I saw a really interesting tweet earlier, Paul, that I'd like to talk to you about and get your opinion on. Again, it's by Ryan Florence, who I mentioned earlier. But he was quote retweeting GitHub, and GitHub was saying, it's basically a quote from CodeConf LA, which seems to be happening. And it says, open source everything you can, and other advice from open source experts at CodeConf LA. And then it links to a blog post. And then Ryan responded with, after running a widely adopted project, I now want to open source as little as possible. And at first I thought that was interesting. I'm like, oh, okay, why would you think that? So I clicked into it and opened, and there was a large number of responses. He followed up with saying, we've got to figure out a licensing model for OSS, open source software, that makes working on it full time as lucrative as being a top engineer in Silicon Valley. And that's what I thought was interesting. Because there are, you know, for example, a good example of this is Vue and Vue Router and Vuex. Those are things that I use very often. And before, Evan had a full time job, and he was working on this stuff at the side. And I was using the software to actively make money, you know, to make a living, something that he was putting out basically for free, right? And then what he did was he started a Patreon, and he said, if I get X amount a month, then I'll work on it full time. And he ended up getting that. But I thought it was an interesting, you know, interesting thought that Ryan was basically saying, I spend all this time on React Router. It's used, you know, by large companies that are making tons of profit, and they're not kicking anything back. You know, they're not financially kicking anything back. Now, I don't know if he has the number of contributors to React Router that are contributing pull requests and such, but he is spending a large portion of his time. And I happen to know that he does have a family, right? It's not like he can spend all of his time on this. Just all the time, right?
Well, and even if he didn't have a family, it's unfair to expect somebody to just, out of the goodness of their own heart, spend all of their time on a project, like regardless of what their family situation is. That's just an unreasonable expectation. I totally agree.
Yeah. So anyway, the thread goes on to talk about a few different things. Like, people are talking about, you know, why not find a corporation to basically take it over, and then you can work for them, and then you can work on this thing full time. Kind of like Platformatic did with Jose Valim in Elixir, right? So he works for Platformatic, who happens to sponsor Elixir development full time. And it just kind of went from there, right? So people were kind of offering all these different ideas, and people were shooting down these different ideas. So I wanted to get your take on that. What do you think? Or how do you think we could go about, you know, solving this problem? Because, for example, with Evan and his Patreon, I happily donate money to that because I make money using something that he makes.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one. I've had some relatively successful open source projects that I work on. Of course, nothing on the level of something like React Router or Vue. But, you know, some stuff that gets a bit of attention. And one thing that I've noticed is just that a lot of developers are so self-entitled about open source software. They'll go in there and kind of demand features and just really, really be kind of rude about it. And that's a bummer for a few different reasons. Obviously, it's important to understand about OSS that a lot of times, in the vast majority of cases, these people are not corporately sponsored. And so it's something they're doing in their free time because they enjoy doing it. It's typically a tool that they use themselves, and they are just releasing it to because they hope other people might like using it too. And that's, I think, just being a little bit more thankful and nicer to open source contributors is such a big deal, and something that all developers should try to focus on. Like, remember that this stuff doesn't have to exist, and it doesn't have to be free. And the fact that it does exist and is free is just mind-blowingly cool. So I would say, just first of all, developers who aren't contributing to open source, be super nice. And second of all, if you're not contributing to open source, why not? I think, you know, go out there, find a library that you really like using, find something that you enjoy, that maybe even that you make money from, and then use it for a while, find some bugs in it. And instead of just saying, oh, there's bugs, give it a shot and try to fix them. Submit some pull requests to libraries that you like. That's a great way to get involved in the community and contribute back. And it helps everybody, including yourself. So I think that, like, just more people contributing is a great, great thing, because open source is such a huge effort.
That's it right there. You know, more people contributing. And if you don't know where to start, look for low hanging fruit, look for spelling mistakes in documentation, you know, look for the things that it would take the author more time to spend on what they're doing to fix. So if you're fixing spelling errors or smaller problems with documentation, the author of whatever library it is, they can keep thinking about the complicated things, and they can keep those continuous thoughts going. They don't have to worry about handling all the smaller stuff. So you're helping them, you know, you don't have to feel like you might be doing a bad job if you're modifying the code base at all, right? It's just kind of an easy way to get started. But number two, more importantly, you know, showing support for somebody and saying, like, hey, this is awesome, thank you for making it, and saying, hey, great job. That's all well and good, but there's a difference when you actually put action behind your appreciation, I suppose. So for me, when I keep using Vue because that's such a huge project that I use on a daily basis. You know, for me, when I say thanks to Evan, he might say back on Twitter, hey, thanks, you know. But it's different when I actually put some traction, I go to GitHub, I clone a repo, and I look for something to fix, right? That, to me, communicates something way more than just sending out a tweet. And even more than that, you can really tell where people's hearts lie or where their intentions lie with where they spend their money. And, you know, so if you really enjoy a project, you know, if there's a tip thing on the GitHub, do that. Just do that. $5, $10, you know, it may not be much, but that to me communicates a world more than, hey, great job.
Yeah, definitely. And I, I don't think that it's reasonable to just go around tweeting at everybody who makes an open source library you like and say, oh, hey, thanks for this thing. That's kind of silly. But if you are communicating them in some way, like, make sure that you're being respectful of them. If you're filing an issue, let's say it's something that's super complicated and you don't want to do a PR, then file an issue, but make sure that it's done in a respectful way. Like, don't go in there demanding that these things be fixed. And I see this far too often where people are just so, they're like, this needs to be fixed immediately. And I can't believe this is broken, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, dude, just take it easy. This is an open source project. Like, say what you have to say. Say there's an issue here. Explain it really well and in depth. Don't just say this thing is broken. You know, build out a reduced test case. Even if you don't want to contribute code, you can always build out a reduced test case. That's always going to be something that's super helpful to the maintainers. Build out a reduced test case. Say, thanks for the library. I found this issue. Explain where it happens, why it happens, if you have any thought as to how it might be fixed. Like, there are so many things you can do to just be a better user.
Not only that, but a lot of people are saying how, or at least I see a lot of articles saying, if you don't know how to get started in open source, start here, start small, start simple, right? Well, if you want to become a better programmer, you need to interact with other programmers and you need to have code reviews, right? And there's no better way to have a code review done than you forking someone's library, making a pull request and saying, hey, how about this? Because they will look at your code and they will tell you what they think about it. And I mean, it's just a great way to learn. I mean, you might get your feelings hurt. That's okay. That's part of growing and learning. But if you don't know where to start, start there. If your pull request doesn't get accepted the first time, it's not a big deal. You know, you don't have to worry about it, but you gain some experience and knowledge from that.
Yeah. And one thing you can also always do is if you have an idea for a feature or if you have a bug that you want to try to tackle, you can always open an issue and ask the maintainers what their thoughts are on that too. You can say like, hey, I would really like to be able to do X because of Y use case. I think it could be implemented in this way. Do you want me to tackle that? I'm happy to submit a PR. I've done that several times, and sometimes I get a response, sometimes I don't, but either way is fine, and at least you're presenting options to them, which I think is a very nice thing to do.
Totally, and I mean, even on top of that, they might see your suggestion, and they might know that, you know, 50 issues ago, they closed one where someone was suggesting the same thing, right? Because they'll probably have more historical knowledge than you will, so I think that's always a smart thing to do. I've done that a few times and had the author either say, yeah, that sounds great, go ahead and do it, or no, we thought about it and we wouldn't work because of this, you know, so because of something that I hadn't considered. So either way, I benefited from the interaction.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks again to Hired for sponsoring this episode of Does Not Compute. Anyone looking for a new tech job should totally give them a try. After you've signed up and filled out your profile, you'll get access to a dedicated talent advocate who will give you profile and interview tips and is there to help with any questions you have throughout the job search process. Sign up at hired.com/doesnotcompute and Hired will double their normal thank you bonus to $2,000 when you find your next job through them. Thanks so much for listening to Does Not Compute. If you enjoy the show, please remember to rate and review it in iTunes. It's a huge help and just takes a couple minutes. Many apps really just didn't have the concept of a JavaScript. Oh my God, Sean.
JavaScript. Ryan Bates.